this, and we've got Reagan here, who's going to kind of lead the way talking about steps 1 through 3 this morning. We're going to have different individuals on the succeeding Saturdays talk about the remainder of the steps. So I don't know how often this is going to happen. It could be a quarterly thing, you know, every 3 months. We'll have different members up here talking about this program and how it's outlined in this book. So I would probably say hold all questions to the end because we are recording, and we'll open it for to Reagan. No, go ahead, sir.
All right. Well, wow, it's a privilege to be here, and it's a privilege to be asked to do this. I was thinking when I was coming up here, my father would probably be really proud. When I first got into this program, one of the things I did, I had a wonderful man who showed me the steps and how to work this. And one of the things he first told me, which I was a little reluctant, he said, we've got this street church down by Fair Park, and I think you need to go down there, because we go down there and we talk about the steps every day. And so for a while I was going down there to what they called the International Street Church down by Fair Park, which basically was a big church, and people come in and be sleeping on the pews, and they were recovering drug addicts. It was reformed prostitutes and just kind of people off the street trying to find a place to recover, and they're trying to help them get their lives about. And so anyways, when I was telling my father about, I'm in the program and these are the things I do, I said, oh, by the way, I go down to this church down by Fair Park, and I'll speak there, and talk to people about the program. And so somehow my dad construed that I was out on a street corner somewhere with this book preaching to people about the 12 steps. And so if he was to know now that I was actually at a church inside a building just talking to a bunch of guys, that would probably give him a lot of relief, because he never told me directly, but my brother and sister said, Dad's kind of worried about you. He thinks you're out on some street corner down by Fair Park, preaching to people. So, no, that's not me. This whole thing for me started really early, real early. My parents, they separated pretty early when I was a kid. They separated when I was about 6 years old. And later on in life, I found out that, unbeknownst to me, I knew that, if you're a fish, you swim in water, and that's all you know. And so my family life, it seemed like the normal one to me. What I came to find out later is that my mother and father, they had a open marriage, which means that they were having affairs with the neighbors and with various asunder of other people around. I think I had a sense that things were happening that, I shouldn't know about, so I don't know how that affected me, but that's what I grew up in. So when I was probably about 7 or 8, I remember I was living with my mother, and I remember, at that time I felt really out of place. I just, being in second grade, and I'm sure there's a lot. Actually, it's kind of ironic because my profession is I teach second grade, and so I can understand that there are some children that haven't quite found their place in the world, and they feel a little off. That was me. Now, I remember one time I was going around, my mom's, our apartment, I was in my mom's room, and I found a Playboy magazine. And I opened it up, and it was like, wow. It was just the coolest thing I ever saw. Now, I assume that most kids, when they would open up this Playboy magazine, they'd look at the pictures and they'd go, wow, that's neat. Especially a kid being about 7, 8 years old. It was more than that for me. I felt lonely. I felt out of place. I remember actually taking the centerfold. And by the way, if someone came in here right now and held that centerfold up that was about 40 years ago, I should say, that's it. That image is burned in my brain. That was one of the first pornographic images that is the first pornographic image I can ever remember. And it is burned in my brain. Ask me what my second grade teacher's name was. I have no idea. You know, ask me other little important facts. Ask me what street I lived on. You know, what was the name of the apartments we lived in? I have no idea. Show me that picture and I go, hey, that's it. That image was burned in my brain. That was the first one. That was one of many. But I took that, I remember taking that centerfold and just laying it down on the floor, spreading it out, and laying down on top of it. And just thinking, oh, this feels comfortable. Now, I was going to go to sleep, but I really couldn't because I kept sticking to the magazine, so actually being able to turn and stuff like that really didn't make that possible. But the thing was, that was my very first experience of finding this sense of ease and comfort in a pornographic image. Now, I didn't tell anyone. I didn't want anyone to know. I don't even know if my mom ever found out that I had the Playboy magazine. And then secondly, also was the question going through my mind is, why does my mom have a Playboy magazine? Is she just did. And that was kind of the way it was throughout my, you know, whole childhood. You know, and the difference between me, why didn't I become another addict? Because Lord knows the opportunities were there. You know, besides finding Playboy magazines, you know, my mom used drugs. So I remember as kids, you know, there'd be water pipes in there that were stained with, you know, marijuana resin, and we'd take them as kids and blow bubbles in them. You know, it's, you know, so why did I become a pothead? It didn't resonate with me. It just didn't, you know. As I got older, you know, it's not like I at 6 and 7 I started collecting those pornographic images, you know, or pornographic magazines. You know, that actually came later. You know, because eventually, you know, I was living with my father, and I found my father. Wow, he had that little nightstand beside his bed, and he kept all his magazines in there. And my stepbrother knew about it. So my stepbrother and I, you know, we were like, you know, on little clandestine missions. We were going to go in there and sneak into Dad's room, and we're going to look through the magazines, and ooh, look at this. And so we did that. And so I learned my dad kept his stash right beside his bed. Now, eventually, you know, my father, he went through many marriages. And so, you know, eventually my stepbrother was gone. I think this was my dad working on his fourth marriage. And he was gone. And, you know, it's just all kinds of craziness. But for some reason, my father decided he was going to throw out all his magazines. And, you know, I would find later in years I would do the same thing. You know, I would get tired of this, and I'd take all my stash, and I'd go take it somewhere. Of course, I didn't ever take it right to my house. You know, I'd load it up in the car, bundle it up in big black bags, and drive some location where it couldn't possibly be related to me, you know. And but anyways, I found my dad's magazines in the garbage can. I was about 12 or 13 at the time. I took all these magazines out, and I took them upstairs into my bedroom, and I kept them in a closet. And to me, it was just fantastic, because every night I went to bed, you know, I was feeling tired. I was feeling, you know, the day was rough. You know, here I am. My family's, I've been separated from my brother and sister because my dad is just acting insane. And my mom won't let my kids, my brother and sister, come and live with him. But I felt like I needed to stay there to protect my dad. And So I'm living in this crazy situation. I've got these magazines here, and here is something, once again, I find ease and comfort with these magazines. Every night, you know, no matter what insanity I've dealt with that day, I've got this little stash I can go to, you know, and I can open up the penthouse and read the letters to the editor, you know, and all of a sudden I have a little bit of an escape. I feel better. Well, this went pretty good for a month or two, but at the time I had a retainer. I had this little retainer, and back then, you know, my wife recently got braces, and she has a retainer, and she said, I remember her telling me, oh, I've got to go get my retainer, and I still had images of what it looked like when I was a kid. They're completely different now. It's just like this little clear plastic thing. Mine looked like an alien implant, you know. It had this little red part, stick you in these little wires and hooked around it, and anyways, those things were kind of expensive. And me being the teenager I was, oftentimes I would misplace it. Well, I misplaced it, and my father was like, I'm not buying another retainer. We're tearing your room up to find that retainer. So they start tearing up my room, and guess what? I'm found out. My dad finds the stash. Well, my dad, he goes, well, step out of the room. And he talks with his wife a little bit, my stepmom. And then he sends her out of the room, and he brings me in. He goes, son, and he holds up one of the magazines. I found this in your room. I said, yeah. I said, I took them out of the trash. He goes, I know. He goes, well, you know, I was a little disappointed to find this, but you know what? You're 13 now. I think you're old enough for these. So, son, keep them in your room. Keep them hidden away from your sister. Make sure she doesn't see them or know about them. And you can keep them. I'm a man now. I am a man. I didn't need a bar mitzvah. I was 13 and my father handed me my personal porno collection. You know? And honestly, this set my mindset for the rest of my life. Now, what I honestly believe and thought is that every man got to a point, every man had one of these. You know, there must be a reason why Hugh Hefner was so rich. That's because every man had to have his collection. And, you know, and so I had mine. And, you know, eventually, you know, things deteriorated between me and my father, and he sent me to live up with my mom. So when I was going up there, once again, my father had given me pretty clear instructions with my pornography and how it was to be handled, and that I didn't need to let others know about it. This was kind of our guy thing. So somehow I found this little suitcase, and that became my little carrying case for my pornography. And so I moved up when I was towards the end of my freshman year in high school. I moved up to Dallas to live with my mom, and I brought it with me, and carried it with me until I finally left the house. No, of course I added to it, you know, because eventually I turned 18, you know, and most kids, you know, at that age, you know, you turn 18, wow, you can drink. Well, yeah, wow, I could drink. But more importantly, I could legally go in and buy pornography now. And that was the big deal for me. So I kept adding to my collection. And I would find that whenever I was in a place where I was stressed or whatever, just simply looking at these magazines, you know, not always acting out, but even just looking at them, gave me an escape from my world. And it continued. Now, it's kind of funny because every Monday I go to a halfway house now in Fort Worth, and I talk to them. And last week I went there. There's this guy there. Normally in our meetings, I can't tell if he's awake or not. You know, he's generally in almost like a comatose state. Well, something happened to him, and Monday night, you know, I'm going through my, we're talking about the fourth step, and we're talking about inventories, and so, you know, I had gone through the week before about resentments, and so I went back to review that, and I was talking about, you know, how, why I want to get these things down on paper, why it's so important, and he pipes up, and he's like, so you got to do all that to get rid of that? You got to go through all that? And yeah, and it just turned into this long conversation of why do you do it? Why do you do it? And he couldn't get it through his mind. It made no sense to him. Granted, he is on parole for sexual assault. But he can't get it through his mind. It makes no sense to him why I have to do all this and why I can't just stop. Why I couldn't just stop. And it was interesting. It was really interesting to be able to go through that and explain to him, I just can't. I can't tell you why. All I know is that I tried and I tried. Because what happened is that as I continued this lifestyle, now up to this point, all this pornography, all this stuff, it didn't really cause me any problems. It was working for me. It honestly was. You know, I had a way where when I was stressed or whatever, I had this sense of escape and I got some ease and comfort. Now, as I went into college, and my first 2 years I lived in a dorm. And the whole thing about my use of pornography is that it was so secretive. It was so secretive, I didn't want anyone to know that I did this. I didn't share it with much of anyone. You know, not even other guys. I didn't want them to know I did this. So when I was in this dorm room, which, you know, gee, was probably maybe about half the size of this room with another guy, and that I'd never met before, I wasn't about to do anything. And then we had communal bathrooms. So even when I, you know, went in to shower or, you know, or even take a dump, you know, I've got, you know, three or four other guys in there. And, you know, we'd sit there and, you know, have showers and have conversations. So I didn't act out. It stopped. So in my mind, you know, if I was to think, is this an issue? It was like, no, it's not an issue. Look, I'm here. So for 2 years, I did nothing. I didn't act out. Now, I can tell you during that time, I sure did drink a lot and smoke a lot of pot. So, you know, I probably compensated a little bit. But to me, it's like, hey, I'm in college. You know, I'm supposed to live a little. You know, that's the whole point for me being here, right? Well, yeah, I might get an education, but, you know, really, I'm supposed to be living. And I went into there, and that's what I did. And so I did, and it's like it was gone. I think I even went ahead and bequested my pornography collection to my younger brother. It's which he took on, and I was really disturbed one time to find it and to find a little jar of Crisco in there. Which I think he had something about him and a girlfriend, and somehow the Crisco got involved. And so he took it to new levels. So anyways, for 2 years I didn't do it. Okay? Now in the big book, they tell a story about this man who was a young executive and realizes that if he's going to be successful in life and in his career, he can't drink. And so what's he do? He stops. And so he's successful in his career. He becomes very successful and is able to retire at a young age because he worked so hard and put so much into it. So, but once he retired, he was like, wow, I retired. I guess I can have a drink now. What do I have to worry for? He's dead in 2 years. Oh, 4 years, was it? 4 years, he's dead. So all that work, 4 years, he's dead. Because, well, he was an alcoholic. He didn't drink all that time. 2 years, for me, I didn't act out. You know, sure, I was drinking a lot. Sure, I was smoking some pot. You know, and any time I could possibly try and get something going with a woman, I would. But that wasn't much, you know. And so what happens was that my roommates, one day, they go out. And one of them thinks that it'd be really funny if he bought the other a Hustler magazine. So I'm going to get him. And they come home and say, ha, 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 look what I bought him. I bought him this Hustler magazine. Oh, can you believe that? Oh, 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 they're laughing. Yeah, oh, can you believe I did that? Oh, this is so funny. Oh, this Hustler magazine. And I'm laughing right along with them. And so anyways, they go out to grab a beer, and they leave me at home with that Hustler magazine. I immediately take that into my bedroom. I'm back in it. Right away. It was just like, here you go. It was an old friend. Good God, I missed you. And then I discover, well, there's this little porno shop, you know, up the highway from Denton. I can go up there. You know, I can rent videos. And so I was back in it. Now, it's still not causing me problems. It's still not an issue for me. I'm doing all these things, but you know what? There's some embarrassment involved. It's embarrassing because I was a musician. I was a music major in college. And I lived with artists and everything, so we didn't feel a need for TVs. We didn't have TVs in our houses that we lived in. Because we were artists, we played music, we drank lots of beer and got creative. So we didn't need TVs. So it made it a little challenging when I discovered I could rent tapes and watch them. But I also found places where I could rent a little TV and rent a VCR as well. So it was a little embarrassing when my roommates would come home and they would poke their head in my room to see what I was doing, and I'm trying to cover up this TV and VCR that I've rented because I'm watching these porno tapes. You know, but it didn't cause me really any issues. It was a little embarrassing. I'm sure my friends probably talked to each other and shared, you know, God, can you believe what he did? You know. But it wasn't causing me issues. And this continued, you know, throughout my life. I just continued with this. Now, eventually, you know, the internet, it's nice to look out here and judge your faces and to know that we're on the same timeline with technology, you know. Because when I talk to younger guys, sometimes it's like, internet? You were there when you didn't always have that? And it's like, no. So anyways, I remember the internet, and actually, once again, I'm over at my mom's house, and I've been out of college a couple years and working, and why on God's green earth my mom decided to share this with me, I have no idea, but she did. My mom, and I think honestly she was trying to embarrass my stepfather, you know, and she goes, oh, you know, we've got the internet now. Yeah, I said, oh, yeah, well, that's neat. She goes, yeah, look at all these pictures that you know, that Felix is finding on the computer. Can you? And she shows me these outrageous pornographic images. And I'm just like, oh, that's disgusting. Oh, I can't believe that. Wow, they have that stuff on the internet. And you know, for whatever reason, she showed me that. Now, I was at the time, I had just met my soon-to-be wife, and I was about to move back up to Denton, but instead I moved in with my mom for a little bit to kind of have a transition place before I decided my next move. So I'm there at my mom's house, and she's gone. There's the internet. So I first now discovered, wow, here's an unlimited pipeline of this stuff. And I start doing that. of course, back then it was a little different because the pictures kind of come up, you know, just a little bit at a time. It's scrolling down. Like, oh, you know, you talk about anticipation. Oh, what's next? You know, you know, it takes me 5 minutes to look at one little image, you know. Wow. You know, it was exciting. And so anyways, all this goes on. I eventually get married. We don't have a computer. And of course, I tell my wife, we've got to get a computer. We've got to get a computer. You know, it's the modern age. My wife is fearful of technology and change, even to this very day. You know, I've really encouraged her to get a smartphone, and she said, oh, no, I don't need that. Just give me one of those simple, you know, little flip phones, and don't send me a text message because I don't know what to do with it. And, you know, and so getting a computer just wasn't a high priority, but it was for me. Because in the back of my mind, I knew, well, I get this computer, I've got pornography, you know, coming right into my house. I'm married. I got porn. Life doesn't get better. You know, I am set up. And so eventually we do. And in the first part of my marriage, my wife, she realized that I looked at pornography. And for her at the time, she said, well, you know, I understand your sex drive is probably much bigger than mine. So, I understand you got to do these things to kind of take care of that sex drive. I'm okay with that. You know. She really wasn't. She accepted it, but come to find out, she really wasn't okay with it. So I did those things. Now, I tried to be discreet about it. But once again, it's not causing me any problems. It's not an issue. You know, the fact that I get up every morning and that I, you know, masturbate before I go to work, you know, and that I get home, and as soon as I get home, I've got to masturbate. And then hoping that sometime within that, maybe my wife will have sex with me. But even if she doesn't, I'm taken care of. You know, but it's not causing any problems for me. It's not. But it gets to a point where it starts to cause problems for me. We have children. And when the children come into the picture, my wife was like, you know what? It's really probably not a good idea for this to be in the house with our children. And I said, you know what? I wholeheartedly agree with you. Because even though I found my father's pornography collection, even though my father gave me his pornography collection, in my heart of hearts, I knew I didn't want that for my children. You know, my son just turned 12. So he's about a year younger. He's around the age when I got my pornography collection. I can't imagine my son looking at pornography. I can't. That's an image. That's something I can't reconcile. Now, I kind of screwed that one up. I'll get to that one in a moment. But I can't imagine that. So when my wife said, I don't want this in the house, every fiber of my being said, I don't either. I really don't want my children to be exposed to this. And I meant it. I meant it at the bottom of my soul that I didn't want them to be exposed to that. But what I found is that I would continue. You know, and eventually it got to a point where I had been laid off. I was laid off when my wife was about 6 months pregnant with our second child. So it was pretty important for me to find employment. As a matter of fact, what had happened when I was laid off is they had said, well, look, I was in management at the time. They said, we really, you know, we're restructuring our management and we don't, you know, need so many of you, so we're going to let you go. Well, we'll let you go, but if you want to, you can take a lesser position. We'll pay you a little more than we do those normal guys, and you can stay on. But I said, no, I'm having a second child. I need to make more money. And so I took a layoff, thinking in my mind, I'm going to just, you know, look at all my skills. I'm a skilled guy. I'm going to go right to work. No problem here. I'll just take that layoff. I'm going to go somewhere else. I'm going to go to bigger, greener pastures. But what ended up happening was I didn't. And so I would spend hours at home on the internet doing job searches. And that was kind of stressful, and that was kind of a drag. So I would go a little bit, and then I would say, you know what, man, I've been 2 hours. My mind is just numb from looking at all these ads, sending out emails, yada, yada, yada. I need a break. So I'll just take 10, 15 minutes here, look at a little porno, and get right back to work. Well, all of a sudden, I look up, and it's 5 o'clock, and my wife is about to pull in the driveway because I've just spent the whole day clicking through porno. I just spent that whole day wasting time. Now, when I turned on that, I had no intention. I had no intention that I was going to spend the rest of my day. I didn't start out saying, wow, what a drag. I think I'll spend the whole day just looking at porno and seeing how many times I can masturbate. That wasn't in my plan, you know. And so I found that that kept happening. I would wake up in the morning and say to myself, I am not going to look at pornography today. I am not going to do it. I'm just not going to do it. But inevitably, what would happen was I would get to a point where it was like, wow, you've done really good. What about a little porno? Yeah, just a little bit. But it was never a little bit. It started never being a little bit. I found that if I had any free time, I had a way of filling it. And I would. Now, my wife, she realized that I had promised her I wouldn't do these things, and she realized I was, through whatever way. So we sat down, we had a marriage therapist. I married a therapist, by the way. My wife is a licensed professional counselor, and so I don't know if any of you have such a benefit, but what that meant was that as soon as I met her, before we got married, we found us a marriage therapist. Now, fortunately enough, we found a lovely man, and we were blessed to be found with him, and matter of fact, even went and saw him a couple weeks ago, and he is truly a saint. But anyways, she realized I was still doing this, and so we had a session with our therapist, and we sat down, and he was like, so you keep doing this, tell me about that. And I said, well, you know, I said, Dave, I sat down, and I tell myself I'm not going to do this, yet I find I'll spend, and of course I was kind of making it a little nicer, I would spend a couple hours looking at pornography, even though I told myself I wasn't. And that seems to keep happening. Now, my wife is a recovered alcoholic. So, you know, being a part of the 12 step was that. As a matter of fact, when I first met my wife, one of the things she said is, you know, I'm so glad I met you. I always thought I was going to marry someone with an addiction. Yeah, but you met me, and so lucky you. I always thought I was going to meet someone in the program. I guess you lucked out with me. So my therapist hears this, and my therapist says, you know, Reagan, it sounds like an addiction. It sounds like you might have a sex addiction. Now, granted, up to this point, I had no idea this existed. Sex addiction? You know what? you could be right. I said, is there something for that? He goes, yes, here, I know this 12-step group. Here's the address. And he gave me the address to the CSD and said, go by there, check it out, see what you think. See if it resonates with you. So anyways, this was around, I think this was around 2002. And this was around 2002. And so anyways, I show up there and I go into one meeting. So I go into a Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous meeting. And I go in there and these guys are talking about all this and that and da da da. And I'm listening to them doing all their talking and talking about their relationships and this one and, you know, and all this different stuff. And then afterwards, some guy comes up to me and goes, oh, so you're new? Well, here's all these pamphlets. And he shares with me a little about, oh, isn't this tragic thing? There's all this pornography, all this stuff. Isn't it just, oh, yes. And I was like, yes, you know what? I am a sex addict. I am. Thank you so much for letting me know. I took all those pamphlets. I went home. I erased all the links on my computer because I figured I was fixed now. I found out I was a sex addict. Man, I have identified the problem. Nothing else will happen. Nothing else will happen. And what happened, though, is that lasted for a couple months, which I really, given the circumstances, was pretty good, you know. But I was back in it, you know. And finally, my wife found out again and says, I can't believe you're back at this. Now, little did she know, this would be the second time of numerous times she would say, I can't believe you're still doing this. And so anyway, so I went back. This time I made my way upstairs to the SAA meeting. And I went in there, and they did it a little differently. And I appreciated this. I was first. They said, any newcomers? I raised my hand. They said, okay, come here. And this lovely man took me downstairs, and he explained to me a little about the program, a little bit about sex addiction. And I can tell you, I wholeheartedly wanted to be a part of that. I really wanted the recovery. Now, I listened to all the guys talk, and everyone shared, and I thought it was wonderful how all these guys would talk about all their stuff and everything. I thought, wow, this is great. I asked that guy right there to be my sponsor, and he gave me all these worksheets. He said, well, here, I want you to go home. I want you to do this and this and this, and, you know, call me. You know, call me every day and do these worksheets and you'll be on your way. Well, I don't think he actually said you'll be on your way, but I pretty much assumed this guy is my sponsor. He's going to show me how. And so this is how I do it. So I went home and I did these worksheets about my personal powerlessness. And so I did all these worksheets. I filled it out and how my life had been unmanageable. I filled out all that stuff. But you know what? It didn't make a lot of sense to me, you know, because I remember one of them was a little checkoff list. And he goes, list all the ways your life has been unmanageable. I said, you know what? I don't see a lot of these, how my life is unmanageable. Doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Well, it's anything. You know, when I was 12 years old, I went into a junkyard and I broke in there to look at stuff. And some guy held a gun to my head. And that's an example of my life being unmanageable. And I was thinking, okay, well, you know, so I'm starting to give the impression that this whole 12-step thing is really kind of, you know, like therapy. You know, I'm going to go through and I'm going to look at all the little issues in my life and I'm going to become enlightened. I'm going to understand how my mind works, how I've reacted to things, and all the events that have led up to me being a sex addict. The only problem was I kept acting out. I might stay sober for a month. I might stay sober for a couple weeks. But you know what? In those months or couple of weeks, I was just, you know, white-knuckling it. You know? A phrase I had never really heard until I went to that program. And but pretty well accurately describes what I was doing.
I was holding on for dear life. Please, God, just don't let me act out. And I thought that's what the 12 steps, and how these guys got a year or a couple years of sobriety was beyond me, you know. But they did. Now, I also realized that it must be important. There's these 12 steps here, and there must be something to that. And I probably need to do something with that. So this guy says, hey, we're starting a step study group. I thought, I need to do that. So I joined this step study group. Now, this book here, I never saw it there. Well, actually, I take that back. They did keep a copy or two in the cabinet with all the literature, but it pretty much sat there and collected dust. I really didn't have much idea what this was, except I knew these things came from here. And but apparently that was all. They were able to give us the, you know, the Cliff Note version right here. So we didn't really need this because we had these up on the wall, and that told me everything that was in here. You know, all the rest was just fluff and had to do with alcoholics, not sex addicts. So, anyways, I joined this step study group, and we didn't read this. No, we were sex addicts. We read A Gentle Path through the 12 Steps, and we worked our way through the 12 steps doing through A Gentle Path. They really should change the title of that book. A gentle and extremely long path through the 12 steps. So after about 18 months of our step study group, and I don't even know if we got all the way through all the steps. I think eventually we just kind of disbanded and said, good God, is this ever going to end? You know. It's like, it's really been nice hanging out with you guys for the last 18 months, but you know what? I've got some other pressing things going on. I'd really like to free up my time on Sunday evenings. And so it didn't get me there, you know. It didn't get me there. And so I kept going to my meetings, and I would go out and eat dinner with the guys, and we would do this, and I would maintain some level of sobriety. But it always came down to this. When the shit really hit the fan, I was out. You know, the perfect example is the most sobriety I had before this point that I do in my life now was for about 6 months. And in that 6 months, at one point, my wife, she had neck surgery. And I had started a new job. I had no support. My wife had neck surgery. I had these two young kids. I'm trying to juggle them. I'm trying to do what... My wife comes out of surgery. She is bound up. She looks like she's on her deathbed. They've got her on a morphine pump. And all I want to do at this time is to be able to care for my wife. But I can't because I've got two young kids. I got to take them home and get them to bed, get them fed, schooled, and all that. So I've got 6 months sobriety. I'm sitting there. I'm going home. I don't know what to do with myself. I don't know how I can manage all of this. So I remember driving home with my kids and thinking, I'm going home. I'm putting them in bed. And as soon as they are in bed, I'm getting on that computer and I'm acting out. The thought was that simple. It's like, look, it doesn't get any worse than this. What are you going to do? How are you going to manage? I always went back to my old way of managing. And I did. And this continued and this continued, and I'd have periods of time. Finally, around 2009, around February or so, my wife and I had been, we were in our room and we were getting ready for bed and we were laughing and joking, ha 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 ha, having a nice time. And my son comes busting into my room and my son says, are y'all having sex? 9-year-old son. Are y'all having sex? No, we're not having sex. We're just in here laughing. We're just joking. It's nothing, you know. We're just having a good time. Well, you sound like you're having sex. And, you know, and Dad, I'm really worried because you keep looking at those pictures on the computer of people having sex, and I'm worried about you. You talk about making a light and laughing moment, making that not so fun. My wife, and of course, immediately, you know, of course, I'm the real upstanding guy. Oh, yeah, I've been doing, I'm so sorry. No, I don't know what you've been seeing. I immediately lie. I'm not going to let it out that I actually did these things. So my wife says, nuh-uh. She takes my son and goes talks to him. My wife comes in there. She says, I can't believe you've done this again. I just can't believe it. And eventually we were able to get some sleep that night. And then we start talking, and she eventually tells me that this is the deal. As a mother, my job is to protect these children. I love you, but I'm a mother, and I'm going to protect these children, do whatever it takes to protect these children. And if it means you've got to leave, then you've got to go. This is your last chance. Any more, and you're out. And I knew she was honest. And most importantly, I did exactly what I said I would never do. I was never going to expose my children to pornography. Guess what I did? Because we would come home in the afternoons, my children would sit down and watch their cartoons, and our computer was right over in this little office. We have these French doors that separate the two rooms. So I would sit there and just kind of turn the screen because my mind told me that my kids they were so involved with their cartoons, they didn't even know what I was doing back there. I wasn't intentionally doing anything. I just thought, I'm bulletproof. I'm invisible. My kids are so wrapped up in those cartoons, they just don't even know what I'm doing. So I just sat back there and kind of click through images, occasionally look over, see, they're still watching cartoons, okay. And just click through those, one after another, oops, you know. And I tried to keep it sedate. You know, I tried to manage it so that if the kids did look over there, they wouldn't see anything too bad. But guess what? I couldn't manage it. I couldn't manage it anymore. That became glaringly obvious. So, I picked up because, you know, at this point, I had kind of stopped going to my meetings. You know, because these 12 steps, there is nothing worse than when you're white-knuckling it and I'm sitting there in front of the computer trying to decide whether I'm going to do it or not. And I go to the first step and says, well, I'm powerless over my sex addiction and my life is unmanageable. So, there you go. I'm powerless. All right. There we go. That little powerless statement, I can't tell you how many times I would turn back to that and it would be like, okay, yeah, let's go. So, I went back to the CSD and I remember the first time I go in there. It's a Friday night discussion meeting. And I get in there and so I decide, you know, I'm going to share. And so I start telling a little bit about what's happened to me. And I'm probably going on a little bit longer than what I intended. And all of a sudden, the chairperson says, excuse me. We have a lot of people here. And so if you could cut this, we have other people that need to share. Okay, fair enough. I guess I have been carrying on a while. Okay, well, that's all. And I sat there. I sat there through 15 minutes of silence with a bunch of guys sitting there in their chairs looking at each other. And I'm thinking to myself, well, good. I'm glad I'm giving these guys an opportunity to share. And to this day, I'm very thankful that chairperson did that, because all of a sudden, it kind of dawned on me, this isn't working. I know, you know, it's kind of like, you know, I keep running my, banging my head into the wall, and it's like, God, I got this horrible headache. You know, and finally it's like, you know what? Maybe this isn't working, you know. But it hit me. Now, I remembered that back then there was this guy, and he had gone off and he had started this meeting where they were reading the Big Book. I remember people talking about, hey, they're going in there studying the Big Book. It's really kind of cool. And I thought, huh. I said, well, you know, maybe I'll call him up, because I saw, you know, we used to, you know, he had started this meeting at this church and I had kind of taken it over and fallen apart. But, you know, I saw the meeting was still listed. So I called him up saying, hey, you know, you still... And I call him up, and no, we don't meet there. But hey, I've got this meeting over at this, you know, the church on Forest Lane, and you know, why don't you come by and check it out, see what you think. I come by, and first off, they say, oh, you're going to need one of these. Okay, sure, you know. And we start reading through this. We started reading through the family afterwards. You know, the upside is that first pornographic image is burned into my mind. The first time I open this Big Book and study it, that's burned in my mind. The family afterwards. Which was perfectly for me, because I was dealing with the havoc I had just wreaked in my family. So we talk a little bit, and I finally asked someone to, you know, hey, how do y'all do it? How is this different? Because they showed me in here that there was something I hadn't thought before. Because all those years I had spent time at the CSD, we always talked about how you would always be recovering. I'm a recovering sex addict. Well, everyone had a different way of doing it. I'm so-and-so, I'm sober today. I'm so-and-so, I'm a grateful recovering sex addict. Well, all of a sudden they showed to me that here it was, that this was a text for people who had recovered. Well, that seems awfully cocky. You're telling me you read this and you got a cornerstone on the truth? Because I've spent years learning about how I'm going to be recovering the rest of my life. And you're telling me you recovered? Yes, we've recovered. Had no idea. Because I had spent, since 2002, I'd spent 7 years trying to recover. And, you know, the idea of being in recovering for the rest of my life seems pretty accurate, you know, because I never got relief. I was always miserable. So anyways, this guy shows, and you know what, he lays out for me, not only does he show me this book, so I'm thinking all these pages, you know, like with most books, you know, all the meat of it's really important. And but he takes me before the book starts, and he takes me to this doctor's opinion. He says, I want you to read this. And all of a sudden, I realize, wow, what they're talking about alcoholics makes sense for me. It makes lots of sense for me. Okay? And all of a sudden, I found that what I had was an allergy. An allergy? Yeah. You know, we believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the actions of alcohol sex for me on these chronic sex addicts is a manifestation of an allergy. That the phenomena of craving, and Lord knows I knew craving. Well, I'm sitting there doing that job search, and it's just like, oh, it's just not working. And I'll just look a little of this. Because I had an allergy. That's what I came to find. I had an allergy. There was no little bit about it.
you know, I was going to do as much as I could and get away with, and then probably try a little more. You know, and then it didn't occur in just the average person, which made sense to me, because I remember back in my college years when I'm doing all this stuff, I would do things, and I'd tell my friends, and they'd be, you did what? That's crazy. Now, I tell you, I went to school with some pretty crazy guys and girls, and I'm telling them how, well, you know, I was driving back from Dallas, and there was this car just pulling up next to me, and they kept looking over at me. They just kept looking at me. And so we both pulled off the highway, because they had nice long hair, and so I knew that this was a woman. I just knew it. And we pull off the highway, and why'd you do that? Well, they kept looking at me, you know, and it was a woman. I thought she wanted to have sex with me. Because this happens all the time, by the way. You know, I'm sure all of you have been driving down the highway, and it's like... And we pull off the highway, and of course, you know, much to my dismay, it's a guy. And it's like, oh, well, he goes, what do you want to do? I don't know. What do you want to do? I said, I thought you were a woman. No. And he goes, well, do you want to do anything? I said, no. I said, you know what? I appreciate you and your lifestyle, but, you know, that's really not for me. Thank you for your time, and I wish you happy hunting. And drove on my way, you know. Now, I tell my friends at college, I said, yeah, you pulled off the highway with a complete stranger you didn't know? Yeah. What do you mean? I thought I was going to get laid. And it didn't make sense to them. But I read through this. You know, he had me read this, and all of a sudden it started to make sense. You know? And I realized that, you know, that to me, my sex life seemed the only normal one. And that was reinforced for me at a young age. You know, my father giving me that pornography collection. Well, everyone does this. You know? And all the things I did, I believed was the normal, right thing to do. And so I started understanding that this wasn't about the fact that I was mentally defective, that I had a bad childhood, I hadn't been raised properly, or any of those things. What it was that I had an allergy, and my allergy was to addictive sexual behavior, which for me mostly manifested itself in masturbating to pornography, you know. And it didn't matter that I had a wife. It didn't matter that I had a beautiful wife, you know. You know, to this day, I share this with lots of people. I'm amazed that this woman is married to me. You know, it's, you know, to this day, it's still got to be one of the biggest mysteries I see on this planet. How this lovely, so together spiritual woman actually looks to me and calls me darling and husband. It's God at work, if there ever was one. But I read through this and I started realizing, wow, that's it. And what he made really clear to me is that I was screwed. That since I have this allergy, there was no getting around it. That no matter what I did, that allergy was always going to lead me back. I have a sex addict mind that's always going to get me to act out. And there was nothing I could do through it. And so he pointed that out here, and it became real clear to me. That's what it did. And all of a sudden, I understood step one. It made sense to me. I couldn't manage my addiction. That if I get a little bit of that craving, I'm going to go on a spree.
And that spree can take me anywhere and take me how long. It never knows how long it's going to take me, you know. I heard someone once say, you know, when do you decide you're going to stop having sex with a gorilla? Well, when the gorilla's done, you know. And, you know, that's pretty much was my addiction, you know. I couldn't call my number. You know, it was funny when I would go out that street church, and there would be, you know, the meth addict, the cocaine addict, the alcoholic, everything. They would always talk about we couldn't call our number anymore. So when I went out and I, you know, was going to start using, I couldn't tell you if it was going to be an hour or 3 days. And the same thing with my sex addiction. Once I started, I came to realize I couldn't tell you if it was going to be this long or all night long. I just couldn't call my number. And so I truly understood that I was screwed. There was no way out. But what he told me is, you know what? I found a way, and I found that in my own life I was able to do these things, and I no longer have that craving. Wow. You no longer have that? That never happened? Hey, you know what, guys? I realize I'm talking for a while. How long did you want me to talk?
Yeah, until 10:30 at least.
Oh, okay. Wow. You know, when you originally told me that, I was like, I'll be lucky to get through an hour. So anyways, he tells me that, you know, yeah, I no longer have that craving. I'm just like, how'd you do it? What did you do? What was it that you did? And so I started to come to number two, because I started to believe that what was working for that guy might work for me. Now, I didn't mention that through all of this, I mentioned a lot, but I haven't mentioned this, that through all these things, I was actively involved in my church. I was leading the youth program at my church. You know? So the idea of God in my life was a very strong fact. But probably unlike a lot of the guys at the church, they didn't come to church with porno tapes stashed under the front seat of their car, because the church was closer to the adult bookstore than what my house was. So being a practical guy, I knew that, you know, I could leave church and go drop off my porno tape and cut down on some gas mileage, you know. So, you know, I'd go in and teach the kids all their Sunday school lessons and everything, and then like, all right, you know, it's time to get back the Anal Adventures of Annie back to the store, you know, before I go home. And, you know, and all the time I'm driving there, I'm thinking to myself, dear God, you know, the thoughts go through my head, I hope no one from the church sees me there. But then again, also I'm thinking, well, if they do see me there, chances are they're there, and so we got a little thing to share, you know, it'll be okay. But the idea of God was not far removed from my life. The problem was that my idea of God was not working, because I still held some idea that I had control of this addiction. I held on to the idea that I could do it, you know. And that's what the earlier program really showed me. My earlier program that I first got into told me that if I go through and I look at my life and I look at all the fears and I look at all the things that led me here, I'm going to be okay. If I can just master myself, if I do enough of this and rigorous enough with it, then I won't act out anymore. I'll be sober. You know, I'll be like that little monk on the hill. And all of a sudden, I can sponsor people too, because, you know, after a couple years, I might get my stuff together enough where people will come to me and say, gee, how'd you do it? well, here's this worksheet and here's that worksheet and read this book and go through and do each little exercise here and come back to me in a couple weeks and we'll talk about step two. You know, because that's how I thought it worked. But, you know, all of a sudden my sponsor was like, no, this is what's wrong with you. I didn't have to write anything. I didn't have to do anything. All I had to do was read and get an understanding in my mind that I had an allergy to addictive sexual behavior and that if I was to act on that allergy, if when I have a craving, I'm going to have a spree, and I guarantee after I have that spree, I'm going to feel remorseful. I'm going to tell you that I'm going to square up and down. And I tell you what, I mean it. Every time I told you I was going to stop, I meant that. That wasn't lip service. That was from the fiber of my being. If you hooked me up to a polygraph right then and said, do you honestly believe you're not going to act out and never do this again? I said, yes, I do. Because I never want to go through that again. Now, if you hook me up to that same polygraph and a week or two later, are you ever going to do this? Well, I'm not so sure. You know? Because all of a sudden, what happened was the allergy, the cravings returned. And all those years in the early part of the program, I just hung on for dear life, hoping I'd get through it. But I didn't. I never did. So finally, you know, I realized with this guy that, you know what, if it might just work for me, what did you do? I see it working for you. I see you're happy. I see you've got this joy about you. I see you're actively working this program and enjoying it. You're driving yourself all the way out here to, you know, Fair Park. Which, oh, by the way, it was interesting, this little street church. I had one guy show up there one day. He goes, you know, I was reading this news article today, and they were talking about the places within the country that's most likely to be a victim of crime. He goes, this is number three. This spot right here. I said, wow, I can see that. But you know what? I looked forward to going there. All of a sudden, I had this joy in my life, and it wasn't convenient. I had a family. I had young kids. I was involved with Scouts. I'm involved with my church. It's not like I just had tons of free time on my hand. But you know what? All of a sudden I realized, this guy told me that, well, if you're going to get the things I've got, you've got to go out and you've got to do some work. That never occurred to me in the other program, that I actually had to go out and do something. You know, I thought doing something meant, oh, I had to sit here and write a book about my life and my thought processes and my experiences and where that all led me. That wasn't the case. So I got to that place where it's like, can you show me? Yes, I can show you. And then he took me in. And he said, okay, well, I think we're ready to do step three. Now, you know, like I said, everything I'd been based on the steps was before this, because I went through the steps before. You know, I didn't get the certificate for completing the steps through the gentle path, but almost. And but I remember step three in there and how we wrote about God and da 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 da, and so all this stuff. And so I figured, well, I've got to do a lot of things. He goes, no, you ready to do step three? And I think I said yes. He goes, you're willing to make that commitment. You're willing to follow these steps. You're willing to listen to me and to do the things that I've done. And he goes, if you do that, you might get the results I got. I said, sure, I'll give it a try. And so he said, okay, well, we'll do it after the meeting. And I met with him, and he says, okay. He opened up the book, and I have to tell a little trick, guys. It's being a sex addict. You know how I find this? The third step prayer? It's so close to 69. it's one of those little things that, you know, I'm a sex addict. I can't help it, you know. It's like, gee, how am I going to remember where the, you know, the third step prayers and third and fourth step stuff? And it's like, oh, well, go to 69 and go back a couple of pages. And to this day, maybe one of these days I'll actually realize, well, page 63, it's right there. So, anyways, he took me into a room, me and him. He goes, open up your book to page 63. And he goes, here's the third step prayer. He goes, now let's get down on our knees. We're going to hold hands. And I want you to say this prayer. And I want you to say a little prayer. You can add on to it afterwards and add, you know, your own little take on things. And that's what I did. I got down on my knees with this other guy, and I read, God, I offer myself to thee, to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. And may I do thy will always. I had a feeling then, I had this sense that I had never had before. I all of a sudden felt lifted. I had had moments where I felt close to God in my life. None of them compared to this. I all of a sudden realized, yes. Yes, indeed. No, you know, in my church, I had often talked about this. We had talked about the prayer of Saint Francis of Assisi. You know, take me, use me as your tool. And those were fine and dandy, and those things made sense. But there was something powerful about getting down on my knees with another guy, reading through this, and believing it. And all of a sudden, I felt different. I felt this connection of the Spirit. I had never, in this program, never had that. You know, there were moments of release. There were moments of empathy, things like this. You know, being in those meetings, hearing those guys tell some of their stories. And I felt awful for them. I felt, oh, the poor guy. Oh, wow, they've really overcome things. But I never had this closeness of myself to the Spirit. And what I started to realize is that not only did I feel this way, but he immediately let me know that, well, you know what? Great. Here's this inventory, and I need you to go do it. Now, in those steps 1, 2, and 3, I didn't have to write anything. All it was, you know, this long-term, you know, recovered alcoholic once told me, steps 1, 2, and 3 can be done on a couch, except when you get the prayer, then you need to get down on your knees. But you can be on a couch and do 1, 2, and 3. Because it all is about that. It's about having that realization that your life is unmanageable and that you're powerless over this thing, you know, and that there is that, you know, can you just have a little belief that there is a power greater than yourself that might be able to show you, give you relief from this. And that's what I was really, that's all those years, those 7 years I spent in those meetings. Lord knows how many meetings. That's all I really wanted was some relief. And bless their hearts. Obviously it works for some guys, because there are guys in there who have some years of sobriety. It didn't work for me. It didn't work for me because I never got relief. Even when I wasn't acting out,
you know, a shift in the wind would lead me there. That's all. It didn't take much to get me back to that place where I wanted to act out. Because I always did want to act out. I never lost the craving. I only managed how to manage it. And all of a sudden, I do that step three, and I feel a loss of it. I feel a loss of that craving. And today, I can tell you, I'm a recovered sex addict. Why can I tell you that? Because I can sit down at my computer now, and I can just go there and go and do what I need to do. And there's not a fear that, oh, well, I might this. There is not this craving of, well, gee, why don't you go do that? You know, I no longer feel like, good God, if my family would just get out of the house long enough so that I could act out, I could get some sense of release and comfort, I'll be all better. Then they can come back, you know, and I'll be a much more pleasant person for them to be around. That doesn't happen anymore. When I am I cannot tell you some of the challenges that I've had to face since I've been in this program. And you know what? But I've got tools now. That's the beautiful thing. It's no longer I have a new tool set. I have God. And I understand and I've seen, and there's nothing that strengthens my faith more than when I exercise it. When I see what seems to be impossible work out. When I see God working in my life, you know, when I see that I don't have a job anymore. Well, gee, I can, I don't know why this always happens to me. I think that I never have the belief that I'm going to be unemployed for a long period of time, that I'm always going to go right into a job. You know what? Inevitably, I am unemployed for some time. But, you know, this summer, I didn't renew my teacher contract. The truth of the matter is, they wouldn't renew the teacher contract with me. I wasn't happy there. They weren't happy with me. But, of course, I thought, I'll go right back into it. It didn't happen. You know, I'm thinking, my God, how am I going to pay my bills? How's it going to happen? Guess what? It happened. You know what? My family and I, we were more financially stable in those months I was unemployed than what we have been before or after. I can't figure it out. Neither one of us can. But it happened. You know, and in that time I was unemployed, guess what? God was calling me to do other things. I had to go to Lubbock, where my in-laws live, and I had to take movements so that we could gain guardianship of my father-in-law because he had dementia and he was about to have adult protective services take possession of him because he couldn't care for himself anymore. And then how do I see God active in my life? As soon as we got guardianship of my father-in-law, a week later, I'm at home. I see a job. I call up this principal and I say, hey, I see you need a second grade teacher. I'm a second grade teacher. Oh, you are? When can you come talk to me? I said, how about right now? Okay, come on down. I go talk to him. He goes, wow, we have a fun little conversation. Turns out he used to be a band director, played clarinet. I was a tuba player. We have this nice little conversation. Hey, this is great. Wow. And he calls me back in the afternoon. Hey, can you come back tomorrow? Within 3 days, I have a job. Why? I honestly believe God had something for me to do. I did it. And, okay, now you can go back to work. These are the things that happen in my life now. And I can't tell you that I'm always perfectly faithful. There are times I still worry and I'm filled with doubt. But inevitably, I know now through exercising my faith what can happen. And so, and it is absolutely wonderful to be up here and to say that now I am a recovered alcoholic. And so, I want to thank you for your time, this opportunity to share with you, and
I wish you the best.
Thank you.
I don't even pretend how to make this thing stop, Ken. There we go.
Oh, boom, boom.